Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of The Sewers of Paris. We're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest Dan Savage says...
Theater is going to die if it can't do something for us that film and television aren't already doing and doing better.
The topic is show tunes, the boys in the band, and the human menorah. If, like me, you are a huge fan of Dan Savage's work, you've probably heard him speak at length about sex and love and news and politics, but tonight's conversation is going to be a little different as we dive into 8-track tapes, secret bike rides, family arguments, and a rule-breaking theater troupe where Dan honed his sense of shock and showmanship long before he was known for dispensing savage love. I'm so excited to bring you this interview, particularly because Dan's work has been a major influence on my own. The very first time I read one of his columns, I was sitting at a desk at my first job, taking a break from alphabetizing videotapes and envying the people who get to write words for a living. Since then, Dan and a handful of other writers have been signposts for my work, inspiring me to write better, to write smarter, to write funnier, to write not just for myself, but to use words to shine a light on ideas and connect people with each other. So it means a lot to me that I could bring you this conversation for episode 100 of The Sewers of Paris. And it also means a lot that you, the listeners, have kept the show going for 100 episodes of interviews and insights and stories and confessions. I do this show because I love exploring the different languages of art and culture, and I'm so grateful to my guests who generously invite us into their stories. And I'm grateful to my listeners for accepting that invitation week after week. Remember, you can visit sewersofparis.com to see video clips of stuff we talked about this week, and click support the show on Patreon if you'd like to join the folks who keep the show going. Now, here's Dan. Well, today I'm speaking to Savage Love columnist and editorial director of The Stranger, Dan Savage. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. You've been after me for a while, and we don't live very far from each other, so I apologize for taking such a long time to get my ass down here.
It's okay. It's a long walk. What is the entertainment that changed your life?
It's really hard for me to pick just one thing, but I might have to go with my parents' collection of 8-track tapes of musical comedies, because my parents were sort of the pre-hippie generation, sort of the last gasp of 50s, 60s, so that was when musicals were still popular entertainment, and my parents had this giant collection of 8-track tapes of Camelot and Carousel and Cabaret and even musicals that don't begin with C. And I was a lonely, faggy mama's boy who spent a lot of time at home, and I listened to them over and over and over and over again. And the sort of gay code in them worked for me.
Then I'll take you away when nothing can get to us. Not anyone or anything.
There's a place for us. Somewhere a place for us, peace and quiet and open air, wait for us somewhere.
Joel Grey's character, there's a place for us. All those cliches are true. All of that stuff touched me. And of course, I was listening to musicals, and this was pre-Wikipedia and pre-internet, and so I would listen to the musicals but not know what the books were, and I didn't have access to the books, so I had to create for myself narratives that linked the songs. So in some ways, I was disappointed when I finally saw the shows, when I finally saw Cabaret the movie by Bob Fosse and realized that, of course, Joel Grey's character wasn't a good guy. Whereas in my head, he was a good guy. Like, If You Should See Her Through My Eyes, that song, which is, of course, I read as, like, kind of gay code. Like, there's a place for us from West Side Story.
If you could see her through my eyes, you wouldn't wonder at all. If you could see her through my eyes, I guarantee you would fall like I did when we're in public together. I hear society moan, but if they could see her through my eyes, maybe they'd leave us alone.
I thought that was sort of beautiful and touching, and this guy defending his relationship in Nazi Germany or pre-Nazi Germany with the Jewish girl that he fell in love with. And then I saw the film and realized what was actually happening during that song, and I was kind of devastated. But those songs, all that collection was really important to me, and it spoke to me, and I'm still a musical theater Homo all these years later. But there's so much else. The Solid Gold Dancers, in the 70s, when really the objectification of male bodies was seriously getting underway. Leif Garrett's album cover with him in spandex pants, which I see now and he looks like he's 12 and I feel really weird about it, but I masturbated about that cover a lot when I was also 12, 13, 14, and it was an age-appropriate target for all of that semen. The Rolling Stones album cover with the zipper. I didn't like rock and roll. I didn't like popular music, but there was a lot of boy on display all of a sudden on album covers in the 70s. And it really helped me figure out who the fuck I was. But then there were, you know, I was a teenager, not, like, I think 14 or 15 when I found a copy of Boys in the Band in a used bookstore. And that really, everyone talks, of course, about how destructive Boys in the Band is, and there's all this criticism of it for displaying such, you know, pathological, self-hating gay behavior. But what I took away from it when I read it was, oh, you can be gay and have friends. I'll just have better friends than these guys do. You live in New York and have a big apartment and your friends will come to your birthday party. One of me might bring a hot hooker. Who knows? And that, for me, was a very hopeful message.
And besides, I want to get to the bars by midnight.
He's a class act all the way around.
What do you mean, get to the bars? Sweetie, I paid you for the whole evening, remember?
Oh, I hurt my back doing my exercises, and I want to get to bed early tonight.
Are you ready for this one?
Well, that's too bad. What happened?
I lost my grip doing my chin-ups, and I fell on my heels and twisted my back.
You shouldn't wear heels when you do chin-ups.
I shouldn't do chin-ups. I have a weak grip to begin with.
A weak grip. In my day, it used to be called a limp wrist.
I know I'm all over the place, but there's all this stuff that hit me all at once. You know, the Leif Garrett album cover, the Boys in the Band, those musicals I grew up listening to, and when I picked the lock and figured out what was really going on in them, Solid Gold Dancers, Male Bodies, and all of that.
Did you have, I mean, it's interesting that you compare it to picking a lock. Did you have, like, a lock pick? Like, what helped you figure out, oh, wait, they're talking about me.
Everyone talks about that, like there's this moment of realization and you sort of walk through a doorway. And it's actually, there are many moments of those realizations where it dawns on you that you might be, or you think that's who you are and you're not sure yet. And, you don't know how it works. I had many, I've talked about this before when people have asked me if there was an It Gets Better project for me when I was a kid. And I was fortunate enough to grow up in the city of Chicago, in the city itself, not marooned in the fucking suburb somewhere. And there were openly gay people by the time I was 13 years old in the city. And it was a thing that people talked about. There was a gay neighborhood that people talked about that I got my ass to. But I remember being in line for Logan's Run with my whole family. And there were two guys ahead of us in line at Water Tower Place, obviously super gay, wearing really tight pants, these crazy belts that went up between their legs, which was a thing for 10 minutes then. And, you know, they look like clones.
Wait, sorry. There was a belt that went between their legs?
It was this thing in the this for 5 minutes in the 70s where you had a belt that went around your waist, but it was extra long, so it like looped between one of your thighs too. It was really stupid and ugly, and I don't want to revive it by accident by talking about it on your podcast. And these guys were holding hands, and my mother put her arms around me, not my brothers, and pulled me toward her, not my brothers, because she wasn't worried about them wandering off the heterosexual reservation, and kept saying to my father, those men are weird. Those men are weird. And I looked at those men and went, oh, right. I get it. They're weird like me. And they were my It Gets Better project in this way because I will grow up and I can appall some woman in a movie theater and be those guys. And I forget the question was.
I don't know. Now I'm feeling about that Michael York is sort of intersecting your life.
Yes, in so many ways.
Yeah.
Oh my God, Michael York strapped to that table in Logan's Run, being tortured with electricity or whatever that was. Yes, that had an impact.
Isn't it funny?
A lasting impact. Yeah.
The things that you look back. For me, like, I worry that I was unduly influenced by the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles because it was this tribe of men who all had huge muscles and didn't wear clothes and never had girlfriends. I'm like,
and ate a lot of pizza but didn't pay a price for it.
I know. It was like the 12-year-old me was like, oh, it's like frat guys, or, you know, it's like the preteen version of that.
Which is funny because my son's understanding of homosexuality when he was little was living with your best friend all your life. Mm. And he desperately wanted to be gay when he grew up because that meant he would get to live with his best friend all his life. And then he figured out that it was not that.
Well, there's also a lot of window dressings too.
Yeah.
So I have so many questions about all the things that you mentioned. You mentioned that you would get your ass to the gay neighborhood.
I would ride my 10-speed the 7 or 8 miles from my neighborhood in Chicago, not get off it, just ride slowly through the gay neighborhood. And thank God I didn't get off it because of what was already worming its way into the gay community when I was 15, 16 years old. I refer here, of course, to HIV/AIDS.
Well, what was the neighborhood like? What did you see?
It wasn't, you know, by the 80s, 90s, the gay neighborhoods had become sort of hip and, you know, the tip of the spear for gentrification. And at the time, gay neighborhoods were depressing and squalid and were only just sort of emerging. You know, it was a big deal. And I think it happened within my teenage and adultish life. It was a big deal when the first gay bar in Chicago got floor-to-ceiling windows facing the street. Which bar was that? The Closet, I think it was called, ironically enough. So, you know, the gay neighborhood was also a hunting ground. The gay neighborhood was where people went to beat up gay people. And it wasn't completely safe for lots of reasons. It wasn't a safe place to be. Looking back now, I can say this, a relatively hot 15, 16-year-old on a 10-speed rolling through that neighborhood, you know, could have been taken advantage of. It also wasn't safe because I could have been beaten to death by gay bashers.
Yeah, who just saw there's a kid in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, and I would dress semi-provocatively because I wanted, of course, attention, and I didn't want it.
Would you have known what to do with attention if you'd received it?
I knew how to put a dick in my mouth by the time I was 15, so maybe I would have known what to do.
The basics. We've come sort of with the basics program.
We will start there.
Yeah. You had all those influences, like the musical theater stuff and movies and Michael York strapped to a table. Did you have people that you could share that stuff with?
Oh, God, no. And there was no internet, so there was no, like, secret gay teenage chat rooms on the internet, and there were no sort of mysterious Twitter friends that you could make and DM with outside of your parents' view. So, no, it was very isolating. Not that a lot of queer kids today don't feel isolated, but there are more options for queer kids today than hopping on a 10-speed and riding into a neighborhood full of drunk adults where you're probably not supposed to be or ready to be.
Well, you know, I feel like that's sort of a double-edged sword because there's a lot of, just as today, there's more information, but more information means there's more bad information.
But luckily, people don't stop usually with one thing they find on the internet. Yeah. When people are curious about their sexuality, curious about their kinks, curious about their gender, curious about whatever, everyone will, you know, point to one bad page and say, oh my God, if this is the only thing someone should read, they will be very damaged by this. I talk to a lot of queer teenagers all the time through my column. I've never talked to one who read one thing on the internet and stopped.
Right.
It's not that you can't be damaged by the one thing you read. You know, I read that horrible Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask by Dr. David Dipshit, I can't remember his last name, when I was 13, 14 years old, and it was very damaging. And a lot of gay men of my generation have that same experience because all of our parents, and if not our parents, then our aunts or our uncles, got that book. And it was ubiquitous on high shelves in living rooms all over America in the 70s and into the 80s. And what it said about gay people was just horrifying.
Did you internalize that? Like, did you believe what you were reading?
I'm lucky in some ways. When I first came out, I used to, you know, the first decade I was out, I would frequently make this observation that I met two kinds of fags when I was coming out. There were gay men who thought there was something terribly, terribly wrong with them, and internalized everything the culture had said to them about being sick or sinful or damaged. And I met a lot of those guys. And I met a lot of guys, hopefully, you know, even then more guys, who thought that there was nothing wrong with them and everybody else was fucked in the head. And I fell into the second camp. Thank God. I didn't think there was anything early on came to, there's nothing wrong with me. There's something wrong with the Catholic Church. There's something wrong with my parents. There's something wrong with the President of the United States, and we are returning to that. There's something wrong with everybody else. Everybody else has a problem. This is not a problem. The problems with this are artificial and manufactured and can be undone. You know, when I came out to my mom, I told her I was a homo, and her first big, you know, counterpoint or counter-argument to that was she was just really saddened because it meant I would never marry. And the first thing out of my mouth was, whose fault is that?
Was that how you talked to your mother? Like, was that like an outburst that surprised her, or was she just like, oh, you made a good
point? They raised us to be argumentative.
Okay.
Irish Catholic, four kids, not enough food. You kind of had to win an argument to get fed. Not that we weren't well provided for, my parents provided for us, but you know, I'm so old. It was whip inflation now. It was, you know, everyone drinking powdered milk because real milk was suddenly so fucking expensive. And so, you know, arguing was what you did. You didn't sit there around the table at night with your noses and phones. You talked. And my parents were almost pariahs in the family because they'd been both raised with children are to be seen and not heard as the prevailing bullshit in their households. And they raised us to be the opposite and to speak up and to argue. And you had to defend a point and win. And so when I came out to my family and there was pushback, I argued with them about it. Won.
It's like a family of debaters. A debate team.
Irish Catholic glib shit talkers. Uh-huh. Not so much, no formal structure to it. Just street toughs arguing.
When you said early on you came to the conclusion that you weren't going to be essentially a Michael from the Boys in the Band, just, you know, like a single tear rolling down your cheek at like how broken you are.
And at the end of that play, if only we could learn to not hate ourselves so much.
Right.
All the criticism of that play, of Crowley, I just think is so unfair because he addresses the criticism in it. And the play looks forward to a time when we do learn and did learn to not hate ourselves quite so much.
Was there a point, you mentioned that interaction with your mother. What was the point at which you started telling people there's nothing wrong with me?
I came out in high school as bi and then quickly thereafter as gay. And I was... I say this to people and they don't believe me. I was the only out gay guy in the acting department at the Krannert Center of Performing Arts at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. There was another gay guy there my first year and then he left and then it was just me. Everybody else, it turns out, in the acting program was gay and they came out after college. And that's what people did then. So who did I have to say there was nothing wrong about being gay to? Everybody. My family, people in high school, people in college. I had a really good friend in college, who there was another kid and I was like, he's in theater department. I was like, he's gay. Obviously gay. He is gay. And I said it in front of this really close friend and she looked at me and said, you think the worst of everybody. We addressed that.
I bet that wasn't something that you were just like, well, I'll let that go.
Yeah, no, I didn't let that go. We unpacked that at great length. Like, I don't think, what? I really don't think being gay is the worst thing.
Wow.
I think being closeted is worse.
Yeah.
Being gay. Being gay is telling the truth. Isn't that a good thing? Being a fucking messy closet case.
So you're there in the theater department. It sounds like there's sort of a direct line from the music that you were listening to as a kid to the work that you went into in college to study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a degree in performance. I graduated college knowing how to fence, but not knowing exactly when people did fence, which is a problem, I think, with theater degrees.
There's probably a really trite metaphor to be drawn from that about, like, knowing how to fight, but not knowing how to control, like, the impulse to fight.
Maybe.
We'll leave that to somebody else. What shows were you in college?
Oh, my God. The Beaux Stratagem. Kabuki Faust. I was in a lot of shows. I can't remember them all.
So the real knee-slapper musical romps.
Yeah, I wasn't in a lot of musicals. We didn't do a lot of musicals. I was in Working, the Studs Terkel musical. But I wasn't in... I was in a lot of shows. I just can't remember them. Some Pinter. I hate Pinter. Some Pinter. I think Pinter's terrible.
Why?
I don't know. It's like somebody put a real play in a blender and then just taped it back together and okay, called it art. I don't like Pinter.
There's this one Seinfeld episode that's like the entire episode's a Pinter reference. Mm-hmm. Do you know the one where they go backwards in time?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was that episode of Seinfeld was my introduction to Pinter. And then I went and looked at it and I was like, I don't understand this at all. What's wrong with me?
I was in that one.
Oh, okay.
I was the waiter.
Okay. Okay. The Pinter play with the waiter
when it goes back in time, there's a scene in a restaurant with a waiter in an Italian restaurant who serves them prosciutto and maloney. I can't remember the name of the play. I smoke a lot of pot. I did a lot, you know, and I did theater when I first got to Seattle. Theater was what I wanted to do. And I had a pretty successful theater here for a while. And then I had to, shut it down because the sex advice racket took over my life and I couldn't give it the attention it deserved. It's crazy that theater is my fallback career in case sex advice columning doesn't work out. But there you go.
Yeah, well, it seems to be doing pretty well for you.
Yeah.
Why? What was the decision to go into theater? Like, did you have to think about that?
It was all I ever wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I did it in, you know, I got involved in the Fringe theater scene in Chicago when I was still a teenager, still in high school, where I first saw openly gay people being openly gay in a room of mostly straight people who then didn't have a heart attack and die. And that was beautiful. You know, I remember I was in Carousel Theater First at the Athenaeum in Chicago on, I think, Lincoln Avenue in high school. And it was a pretty, you know, for a community theater, pretty fucking professional. Like, Theater First was a 30-year-old, 40-year-old community theater that had chops, man. They did great shows. Great sets and costumes, a full orchestra, real conductor, just like crazy. And there were a couple of the male dancers were these ballet boys who would kiss. Like, they would, you know, before the curtain go up, people are on stage stretching and doing their, like, theater bullshit. And they would, like, dance and stretch and do some on point, and every once in a while they would lean on each other and kiss, and nobody would have a heart attack. And there were 5-year-olds in this show and nobody had a heart attack. And so thank God for them. I was still closeted at that point. I think I was 15 years old.
What was it about the theater that you liked?
I like storytelling. I like camp. I like art. I like musicals. I don't know. Like, what is it about football that my brother likes? I'm not sure he could articulate it very well either, but he sure the fucking likes football.
Well, the stories that you cited there, like the plays, you know, Camelot, all the C's, the Camelot and the Cabaret.
And Carousel.
Those are
Nazi Germany, domestic violence, and the collapse of a pretty decent governing. The collapse of a country, the collapse into fascism of another country, and the... And domestic violence. Those were my big three musicals when I was a kid.
But we're gonna sing about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there something there about, like, confronting difficult issues in a way that musicals made them tolerable or approachable?
There's something about channeling inner turmoil into a big, belted-out number, I think, that appealed to me. You know, one of the things that you're forced to do when you're young and gay and closeted, and other people know you're gay before you know you're gay because you're getting beat up or called a faggot when you're 7, is you have this inner monologue that's just screaming at you all the time. You begin to police how you move and how you speak and how you walk, and you become hyper conscious of how you're performing yourself that day, and you become hyper conscious of who is my audience at this moment. And I really think that that's why there are so many queer people in theater, because we grow up acting. We grow up performing straight, and then at a certain point we're like, fuck this, I'm performing gay, which is usually why we go a little bit nuts when we first come out and we overperform the gay.
What was your overperformance of the gay?
I pierced my ear. I had a pink flamingo earring for a while that dangled. I wore, it was fashionable at the time, painter's pants. It was an ugly era. I had a red garnet stud that I would sometimes wear. On those occasions when the enamel pink flamingo was too much, I would wear my red garnet stud.
I love the idea of a pink flamingo. Was that a reference to pink flamingos?
No, I've never seen pink flamingos.
Really? To this day?
Yeah, I've also never watched Two Girls, One Cup. I've heard about pink flamingos enough to know that I probably don't want to see that scene. But I appreciate John Waters and everything he did, and I love camp, and I love some of his other movies, but I think I'll have to skip pink flamingos forever.
It's, as it compares to, like... This is maybe the wrong way to refer to these things, but the squeaky cleanness of a musical comedy, the polish and the pizzazz, John Waters' aesthetic seems to take that in a different direction.
But I didn't like squeaky clean musicals.
Thematically, like visually, they're great.
But... Yeah, visually, they're very beautiful. But, you know, one of my favorites when I was very young was Sweeney Todd, and they're slitting throats in Sweeney Todd and chopping people up. It's pretty dark.
It's priest, have a little priest. Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh, so it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's at.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
No, you see, the trouble with poet is how do you know it's deceased? Try the priest.
Yeah, so you mentioned that you liked camp. Was that something that you noticed, or was it something that just sort of, like, what were the campy things that kind of sprung up around you that you loved?
The Carol Burnett Show. But my first exposure to camp wasn't gay camp. Paul Lynde on Hollywood Squares.
Okay, well, you made up for it.
Charles Nelson Reilly. Mm.
What role did you encounter Charles Nelson Reilly in?
TV talking head.
Mm. Personality.
Yeah, personality. It's funny, you know, they're about to revive Hello Dolly on Broadway. I hope Bette Midler listens to this show, because I hope they don't make the mistake that everyone makes when they revive Hello Dolly, which is there are two, there's this character, I can't remember his name, who is, you know, like a 30-something plus old virgin that she helps get laid. She helps pair him off, and...
Is that Barnaby?
Maybe it's Barnaby.
Anyway...
But, you know, there's the guys who work in the store, and there's him and his sidekick, and they're, and because everybody has to be like a romantic leading man now, they cast a romantic leading man in this role, and the role was originated by Charles Nelson Reilly on Broadway. There's a reason this guy is a 35-year-old virgin who works in a store and is scared of his boss. He's inept, and he's probably a faggot.
Hello, Dolly, the great song that I used to change by upstairs. It's true. Was sung by lovely Miss Carol Channing. I'll never forget that opening night. Again, history was made. I remember in rehearsal around the corner. Were you there? Hello. I said to Gower, who wants to come down the staircase anyway? Well, it's true. Would you? First of all, my eyes are bad. But more importantly, I much rather change. You see, because then when I came down, I could come out from under the table in the hat shop and introduce Jerry Herman's immortal, perennial triumph, Motherhood March. I stand for motherhood, America, and a hot lunch for orphans. Take off your hat, sir. Betsy Ross's flag is passing due. You see him on the hill at Gettysburg. Neath that great triumphal arch. Chills, chills, chills. A career of chills.
I'm dreading going to see Bette in Hello Dolly, which I'd really like to do, and seeing that role miscast, which throws the whole play off.
Right, it's Darren Criss, the 30-something-year-old version of Darren Criss.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope that doesn't fucking happen.
Who would you cast?
I don't know. Like, you would cast, you know, 20 years ago, you would cast Nathan Lane.
Oh, Josh Gad is today's Nathan Lane.
Josh Gad. That would be a really good choice, actually. Josh Gad for Barnaby. I think it's Barnaby. I think you're right. God.
That would be so much fun. Okay, well, let's... So, Bette, I know you're a faithful listener to this podcast.
So, camp... my theater aesthetic really developed... I moved to London in the 80s for a year and a half and saw tons of theater that really had an impact on me. And then I moved to Berlin, and I was in some shows at this English-language theater called the Berlin Play Actors that had a kind of drag aesthetic and would do a lot of cross-gender casting in 1988 and 89. Before everybody did it. And those experiences really impacted me because, you know, I grew up taking theater very seriously. And what is realism? Realism is not pretending the audience isn't there. Realism shouldn't be pretending you're not actually in a play. Realism shouldn't be pretending you're not actors. You're really actors. You're really putting on a play. You're really telling a story. You're really wearing costumes. You're really in a theater. You're really putting on a show. And so for me, camp and artifice is more real and true and honest than fourth wall bullshit. And I grew up with a lot of fourth wall bullshit as theater. And I find it really hard to watch those shows. I'm going to get really boring and theater geeky on people if you let me keep talking.
Please, please.
Well, just, you know, theater is going to die if it can't do something for us that film and television aren't already doing and doing better. You know, why should I go see Les Liaisons Dangereuses when I can watch John Malkovich and Glenn Close in the film, filmed in France? Of course, you have to put up with Keanu Reeves, who's super hot, but not quite convincing. And Much better in other films if you're listening, Keanu. I love you. Just you were miscast in Leslie Elson Dangerous. Why should I go see that if it's not going to, if it's going to just like hint at the movie? You have to, and I'm not just, I'd had a lot of audience participation in my plays when I was directing. And I'm not just talking about audience participation, but being in the moment with the audience. And everyone pays lip service in theater. You know, there's this connection between the audience and the actors. You're creating this thing on stage. It's just going to exist this once. And bullshit. Because I've been in theaters where somebody, you know, passes out in the aisles and the actors are all there pretending nothing's happening in front of them.
Wait, what was the circumstances there?
I was in a theater and they were doing Richard III. Where it has a character in it who addresses the audience directly and talks to us, and somebody collapsed. And they just pretended this wasn't happening, as this person is carried out of the theater.
Oh, boy.
And for me, in the theater, that needed to be incorporated into the show. One of the things that we would rehearse actors in my company in is, like, dealing with what the audience gives you and incorporating it into the show. So that if, you know, the example I always love to use is, we had this actress who played Macbeth and, named Christina Maston, and the witches came in dragging Lady Macbeth's body onto the stage and said, "The queen, my lord, is dead, 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 dead," and dragged her off, and everyone's laughing. And then it's the Tomorrow, Tomorrow, Tomorrow speech, which Christina played just straight.
There would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow. And tomorrow. And tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle.
And those were the on-a-dime moments in my plays that I loved, where we would go from high camp to, like, knocking Shakespeare out of the park, like, really doing it. And she was trying to start this speech, and there was some woman in the audience who had the giggles who couldn't stop. And what she did was, the woman kept giggling as Christina's launching into the speech, and so she stopped the speech and looked at the woman and gestured to her, like, "Can I do this? Can you calm the fuck down?" And the woman, like, put her hands over her mouth and calmed down, and she began again, and the woman started giggling again. And then she did it again, and the woman stopped, and then she started, and then the woman started giggling again. And she walked off the stage into the audience, took the woman by the hand, brought her up onto the stage, sat her down on a bench beside her, and did the speech directly to her. Just eye to eye, nose to nose, did the speech. It was a gorgeous moment of theater that one time, never again. Because my company wasn't in denial of the fact that we were playing before an audience. Now, we're not the only people who would do this. Other people are able to do this. Drag shows are able to do this all the time. But this is what theater has to do. And everyone in that audience that night didn't think, "I could have watched Orson Welles' Macbeth." Everyone in that audience was like, "I saw a Macbeth that no one else will ever see ever again."
With all the acting that you were doing, you said that once you started doing directing, when did you move from just, "I'm going to be in someone else's story," to, "I've got a story I want to tell"?
Like, by directing shows? Story I want to tell?
Were you just directing, or were you writing?
No, I was directing. Would do camp recontextualizations and queer recontextualizations of big famous plays. Morning Becomes Electra, St. Joan, King John, Macbeth. Those were the shows that we did. And we would turn them on the head and make them funny. You know, the thing I realized when I saw so much Shakespeare in England was there's no such thing as a Shakespearean tragedy. They're all comedies. Some people die at the end of some of them. But every tragedy I saw was not played for laughs broadly, but were really fucking funny. Hamlet's a really fucking funny play. So is Macbeth. If you aren't, you know, desperately trying to smother the play because you think that if you get a laugh that you've betrayed the seriousness of the Shakespeare that you are bringing to the stage. And seeing Titus Andronicus, I think Susan Stroman directed it. I think it's Susan Stroman? It's a famous director. I'm going to get her name wrong. Directed Titus Andronicus, and I saw it with Brian Cox in London in 1988 at the Barbican. It was fucking amazing and fucking hilarious and fucking horrifying. And, you know, the character gets raped and her tongue gets cut out and her hands get cut off. It's, you know, other characters are decapitated. People are have their children fed to them. Their sons' heads delivered to them in buckets. It's awful and fucking hilarious. And by making you laugh and then turning on a dime and gutting you. Like, you're vulnerable when you're laughing. You're physically vulnerable when you're laughing. You're emotionally vulnerable when you're laughing. It's easier to slip the knife between the ribs and break your heart if a second ago you were laughing. And you like characters who make you laugh better. So then to see those characters done in is more heartbreaking than if you're just like, oh yeah, there's old Macduff. He's so serious. But if Macduff, who has some funny lines, made you laugh in Macbeth, then when, you know, his whole family gets killed, you're a little more upset for Macduff.
Right, right. Are you a defender of the controversial scene in Showgirls?
Oh, the rape scene in Showgirls?
Yeah.
Have you interviewed David Schmader yet?
Not yet.
I saw Showgirls once. I'm not a huge fan.
You're not a Showgirls scholar.
I'm not a Showgirls scholar or a Showgirls queen. I've heard all the criticisms of the brutal, slightly pornographic rape scene. I'd be interested to hear what David had to say. He'd have more to say about it because he is, of course, the world's preeminent Showgirls scholar.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I love that you were able to put comedy into these very serious, like surround the seriousness with the comedy, which is actually something Ben de la Creme was just talking to me about. The ability to, you know, how subversive. Ben de la Creme is a local cabaret and drag performance.
Not local. He tours now. He's all over the place because of RuPaul's Drag Race.
I want Seattle to claim him, even though he's not even from Seattle. But he's from Chicago. So, you know, Seattle's claimed you both. But they've adjusted Homo for the Holidays, which is the holiday show, to have a lot of references to contemporary heartbreak and tragedy. Because, as he said, comedy and laughter is a great subversive way to poke fun at the things that, you know, it's just too horrible to talk about otherwise.
We did Children's Hour by Lillian Hellman in my queer theater, which was fucking hilarious. We set it in a boarding school for daughters of prominent Republican families, for these girls who have speech impediments. So everyone had their own unique speech impediment, including a character played by Mia Levine, she was so great, who drooled and couldn't control the drooling. And Mia Levine is the world's greatest theatrical drooler that you've ever seen. Because she would have these ropes of drool hanging from her face all through the show. I don't know how she did it. And every once in a while, one would like spin off into the house. Like, people lost their minds. But we were making fun of, at that time, we thought, you know, the worst Republican administrations, you know, although it was a Clinton era, but we were making fun of like the Reagan Bush era. We were just right out of Reagan Bush.
Right.
And so everybody was like, we changed the last names of all the girls to Dole and Gingrich and Reagan and Bush and poked fun at it to bring it down to size. Yeah. You have to roll with what you got. And we had a lot of AIDS jokes in our shows. Our theater's name was Greek Active, which we chose because we thought it was hilarious then to see that in headlines. Greek Active knocks it out of the park. of course, Greek Active, for those of you who don't know, was an old gay personals ad way of saying that you are the top. You like to fuck ass. You are Greek Active as opposed to Greek Passive. And the first show we did was Medea, which is a Greek tragedy. But what was I going to say? Oh, but, you know, it was the height of the dying. It was 92, 93, 94. People forget that the largest body counts in the HIV AIDS crisis stage was not 86, 87. It was 93, 94, 95 before the drugs came online. And our motto for Greek Active was, my life is drama, make me laugh. Because we were constantly burying friends and people were very sick and dying all around us, even here in Seattle. And our theater company needed to be a break from that. So we're going to do this tragedy and you're going to love it. In a way, we were all living tragedies and we had to find a way to love our lives. And that's what we were trying to put up on the stage.
How difficult was it to find parallels between, and maybe it wasn't very difficult at all as I ask this question, between like Greek classics and the HIV epidemic?
You just set it in a gay bar.
I guess.
Which is what we did with Medea. We set it in a gay bar.
Ah.
And Medea was this queen in the gay bar. And her sons were just like bar boy dancer boys. And it worked. It translated.
Well, was there just like, did it feel like this flash of like, oh my gosh, this has been sitting here all along, this comparison, we just stumbled upon something?
No, it just, it just, you know, in a way, and this is what I think the challenge is always for fringe theater and, you know, not a lot of money theater. You have to make choices that were forced on you look like they were choices you made. Mm. We had a gay bar that we could do this show in, so we had to set it in a gay bar. It wasn't like we could have, we, you know, we set it on a Zeppelin or set it on the Queen Mary 2 in 1940 or in this gay bar. Like, we had a gay bar, we had a dance club where we could do this show, so that's where we made it work and figured out a way, and it kind of did work. Like, Medea's a fucking drama queen and a vicious, murderous, vengeful, jealous, heartbroken woman.
I know.
Created by a man, written by a man. Why shouldn't it be played by a man in drag?
I mean, it's what you're describing sounds a bit like, oh, I can't believe I've forgotten her name. Dame Edna.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, or Lady Bracknell.
Absolutely. And the whole, and our whole idea with, my whole thing with plays is we would take these, like, terribly familiar plays like Macbeth. There's a reason people are always doing, like, Hamlet in the 20s, Hamlet in Nazi Germany. You have to take these stories that everyone's familiar with and make them strange again, so that they let their guards down and they stop anticipating what's coming. And, you know, if you do Hamlet and you set it in, you know, the 30s, or that famous Richard III with Ian McKellen set in the 30s, the rise of fascism, you know, people still know what's coming. But if you make it queer and you put people in drag and you turn it upside down and inside out and you create some standalone scenes, maybe, and you cut some shit, people stop and they don't know where you're going with this. They don't know if you're going to do the ending or not. They don't know if you're going to do the iconic moments or not. And what I found directing a lot of these plays was, you know, these plays with iconic moments, like Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, like The Miracle and Miracle Worker, is that if you make it strange enough, audiences will have the same reaction that audiences had who didn't know the play at all the first time they saw it. And that's, I think, a real challenge for theater people to recreate, is that experience of it, to make a familiar story so strange that people stop projecting themselves to the end of the play and dinner or drinks after. Mm. You know, if they can tell themselves the whole story in 10 seconds sitting there waiting for the show to end, you fail. You have to make them think, I don't know what the fuck they're doing with this. You know, we did King John. Sorry, I love talking about when I did theater. Obviously, this is where my passion lies. We did King John. It's this wonderful play by Shakespeare. Some great scenes in it, great characters. It's rarely done because it kind of doesn't work. It kind of sucks. There's also no ending. It just kind of the play stops. And so we get, and my thing was always embrace what's wrong with Shakespeare. Like, if there's a problem with it, don't, like, try to brush past it because you have to, like, worship Shakespeare and he's a genius, and he is. Like, the fourth act of Macbeth, nobody knows that that takes place in England until about three quarters of the way through. Usually audiences are, like, lost. And when we did Macbeth, the Union Jack rolled in. We had a picture of the Queen on the wall. God Save the Queen played. They were drinking tea. Like, we were like, we are in England. We are in England. Right? And even then, that act is hard to follow. So there's a character, I think it's Macduff who says, or Malcolm who says, you know, here in England. And we had another character go, wait, what? We're in England? And Macduff looked at him like, just totally breaking, like, yeah, the fucking asshole, we're in goddamn England, what do you think all this shit is about? And then the character went, because the act is still hard to follow, and the character went, well, what are we doing here? And Macduff pulls the Folger Shakespeare Library paperback edition of Macbeth that all of us had in high school out of her pocket and reads the scene synopsis, reads the act synopsis to this idiot. And the audience is, of course, the idiot's the stand-in for the audience at that moment that is lost. So we had the only production of Macbeth ever where everyone knew we were in England and everyone knew what happened in Act 4. Because we didn't pretend like we could fix it with the words that Shakespeare gave us. Mm-hmm. That we had to work around what Shakespeare gave us. And the same thing we did with King John. It ends and it stops. And it's not very satisfying. And rather than pretending that wasn't so, we had this character, the bastard, who directly directs the audience throughout King John, look at the audience and say, that's it. That's all she wrote. That's a suck-ass ending. Like, so much build-up, and that's all you get. Sorry. But you paid your money, and you deserve an ending. So here's the last 10 minutes of Hamlet. And the entire cast that had, like, walked off the stage at the end of the show runs back on in full Elizabethan everything, and a new set sort of kind of comes in at the back. That's full Elizabethan. And it had been a modern dress, military fatigues, t-shirts and jeans and combat boots, or, you know, combat fatigues and jeans and boots production of King John in this dark and sweltery space. And suddenly it's this candy-colored Elizabethan, you know, Shakespeare in the Park production of Hamlet. And we do it. We did the last 10 minutes of Hamlet from the Laertes Hamlet sword fight.
That must have been magical. How did the audience react?
People went bananas. And it was because we didn't pretend that King John was perfect. Mm-hmm. We were like, King John has a problem. There's no ending. You deserve an ending. Here's an ending.
That's so great. When I was in high school, I did, I directed The Importance of Being Earnest. Because,
you know, that was our first show at our bar when we moved into Rebar. We were the theater company that made Rebar a theater.
Oh, what? Really? Yeah. What was it before that?
They would do sort of one-off drag shows on their little stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went to Steve Wells, who was the owner of the Rebar at the time, and said, I want to run shows here. We want to open a play and run it. And we would. And we did kind of run a little Shakespearean. I would put up the money, and then we would earn that money back, and then everybody who was in the show had a share. If you were in it and you did the costumes, you had two shares. And then at the end of the weekend, after the whatever it cost to mount the show was paid back, everybody got a split. I was really proud of the way we ran that theater, and we did it in that bar. And because we were the first theater to approach the bar, we wouldn't have to close, because they didn't have something coming 3 months later.
Mm.
It was our theater. So we would open, St. Joan ran for like 10 months.
Wow, okay.
Which I think more French theaters should fucking do. French theaters all the time are closing shows that people want to see, mm-hmm. and then complaining that they have no money.
Mm-hmm.
Don't fucking close shows that are selling out so that you can open The Seagull and play it for six people.
Sure.
When you've got some show that everybody wants in town wants to see and can't get tickets to.
So instead do it like a movie theater where it's just like, well, people want to see it, so we're going to keep running it.
We're going to run it. Do it like a theater, not a movie theater, a fucking theater. They don't close shows on Broadway because another show's coming in. There's no other show coming in unless this one closes. And more fringe theaters should do that. I find it very frustrating when fringe theaters beg for money, plead poverty, and then close shows that could have been cash cows.
Right. Well, I think Importance of Being Earnest was a pretty savvy show to start with because people know it, people love it, and it sounds like your approach, I'm sure you weren't like, oh, reverent about it. Oh, Oscar.
We weren't reverent. We set it in Dallas, Texas, and there was a fist fucking in the Cecily Algernon tea scene. Yeah, I would say we weren't reverent. It is amazing how well a fist fucking went with the script. It wasn't like there was these co-concurrent events at suddenly where they were doing Importance of Being Earnest and on the side there was a fist fucking happening. No, it was like it kind of worked. It fit right in. It didn't distract anybody from the machinations of the plot.
Who was fucking who?
Algernon was fist fucking Cecily.
Okay. I'm just trying to imagine. First of all, that seems wildly inappropriate for their relationship. But, like, at what point? What are they saying?
I can't remember. That was a long time ago. It was 20 years ago.
Wow. Okay. So you did all these great classics. And did you fill the house? Like, did people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we sold out shows. And we did. And another one of my sort of theaters got to compete neuroses or approaches was our tickets were a buck cheaper than movies.
Okay.
So whatever movies were charging then, I think it was $8 or $9. We were $7 or $8.
So you were doing this while you were...
And now I go to Rebar and I see people charging $25 to go see a show where they're reading from scripts for one weekend.
Okay.
Which I appreciate. Like, I've been to the Brown Bag Theater. Like, we're going to do... whatever that other Keanu Reeves movie is, Point Break. We're going to do Point Break on stage. And it's hilarious. And they're charging so much money. And I'm like, oh, wow, we had sets and costumes and posters and lighting and props. And we charged $7.
Well, yeah, times being what they are. That Brown Bag, they like, it's such a pleasurable, like, I was about to call it a guilty pleasure, but there's no guilt about that.
No guilt.
No, just taking... I guess it's sort of the reverse of what you were talking about, and also not the reverse of taking something that people are like, oh, I know what that is.
And making it strange again.
Yeah, yeah. Making it strange.
And also, movies are now our mythology.
Mm.
You know, when Shakespeare wrote, and, you know, an educated audience up until, you know, the last 30 or 40 years, would get the references. You know, these were often riffs on and retellings of famous myths or political dramas. And now people, you know, they don't have any idea what the hell's going on in Midsummer Night's Dream. But they know exactly what's going on in Fast and the Furious.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what's amazing is that when you... I look back at these old plays and I'm like, how are people so smart? I'm putting in air quotes here for podcast audience. So smart they were able to follow Shakespeare back then, but I guess...
Because they didn't have Twitter.
That's, attention spans were different.
And I'm not one of those theater people who like then blames the audience for that. You have to do the work for the audience. You can't expect the audience to sit there and connect the dots for you. And so if your audience is not going to get a reference or a riff in Shakespeare, what the hell he's talking about. You have to make sure that that's played in such a way and rolled out in such a way where they can be brought along. That's your job, not their job. You can't just sit there with your arms folded over your chest, bemoaning the fact that audiences these days aren't conversant in Greek mythology.
Right, right. I had this combat with some commenters on an article I once wrote where I compared, it was the stupidest thing. I sent some metaphor about like how the city was fixing streets, and I compared it to like fixing a cake. And I like went way down in the weeds on how you like repair like a crumbly cake. And nobody wanted to read that on Curbed. Like, it's a real estate blog. It's the people in the comments. And I just took it as this personal affront. And then I realized, oh, maybe think about your audience a little bit better.
Yeah, or bring them along.
Exactly.
Perhaps you needed to write about fixing a cake in a way that was more amusing for people at that particular site?
Yeah, exactly.
Or more relevant to them?
Well, I mean, there's only so much I could say about patching a sidewalk. So God. No, but it's true. I could have talked about that. It was on one of those streets that's a staircase, and so there's lots of interesting things to say about those weird streets. Anyway.
Are there? I'm going to challenge you on that. Are there lots of things?
I think there are, because there's sort of this hidden history of like the weird Barbary Lane type, you know, passageways that cities have to build to connect things that you'd never think would have to be connected. That's my defense of street scholarship. So you were doing these shows at the same time that you were working at The Stranger, right? You were getting The Stranger all built up.
Yeah. Doing The Stranger, writing a couple of books, doing these plays. It was great. It was a great time. But I couldn't, you know, The Stranger got to be so big and Savage Love got to be so big and I had more writing to do and op-eds to do, and then I had to go on TV and then I had to stop doing theater, and it bums me out. I really miss it. I love putting on a show, a good show. And anybody who comes to my like live tapings of the Savage Love cast, half of what we do can't be on the Love cast because it's visual, because I can't not put on a show. We did a Christmas show for the Love cast, live taping here in Seattle, and I have this rant I roll out every year where Christmas is not fucking sexy. Stop taking pictures of your hole in front of your goddamn Christmas tree bent over on your elbows. These things don't work together. There's Christmas and there's sex and what's sexy, and they are never the twain shall meet. You can put a million Santa hats on a million go-go boys. It's not going to be fucking sexy. So we did a show about Christmas isn't sexy, and we had, you know, adult baby Jesus out there to prove there's nothing sexy about that. And the last thing was we had a podcast. I had a giant functioning crucifix constructed, and we had...
Functioning in what way?
Well, you could put a boy up on it, which we did. And so I said, you know, at the end, I was like, you want a Christian holiday that you can perv and that is sexy? It's 4 months later. Just hang in there. The sexy Christmas holiday is like Roman soldiers and floggings and a ripped guy with abs on a cross, like that's your, and fertility rituals that have been folded. That's your sexy fertility. And as I'm talking about this monologue, like the curtain opens and there is this tableau vivant of Roman soldiers and hot, sexy Jesus up on the cross, which was a hot 27-year-old guy with no beard in a leather jockstrap and combat boots up on the cross. Cause it's my Christmas or my Easter, my idea of sexy Easter. And that was for a podcast, which then we couldn't use any of it.
Sure. You have to have like somebody describing, and now the curtain opened.
Right. So I can't resist still to this day putting on a show.
I do sort of want to challenge you on Christmas not being sexy. I think there's something inherently sexy about gift giving, about the surprise of...
Those two words together because of some bullshit in the 90s. Remember when people were trying to give each other HIV? There was a small subset of people who had fetishized contracting HIV or infecting someone with HIV, and they called it gift giving.
No. Oh, yeah. God. Ugh. Okay, so not that.
So you're using that phrase over and over again as giving me sort of panic attacks.
Okay, so how about the surprise of bestowing somebody...
Prezzies,
yes. Okay. Because I think that can be kind of sexy. I think I think the giving of things can be sexy. Okay. I mean, it doesn't have to be. You could give your cat a piece of catnip for Christmas, and that's not sexy, but...
You can open a Christmas present, and there can be something sexy in there, I guess.
I guess it doesn't have to be necessarily Christmas.
But it's sexy in opposition to its packaging, the time of year it's being presented to you, everything else aesthetically going on around Christmas. It's the contrast between the sexiness and everything else that perhaps makes it sexy, but it doesn't, by some love, transubstantiation, retroactively make Christmas itself sexy, I would challenge you on that.
I think
you can be given a sexy present that doesn't make Christmas sexy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm thinking about like all the what sexy Christmas stuff I can think of is all like not inherently Christmassy. Like it's, oh, we're snowbound in this cabin over Christmas. Well, I mean, you could be snowbound in a cabin at any time. Okay. And there's nothing inherently sexy about Rudolph's nose, I suppose.
No.
Try as one might.
I'm trying not to think. Make bestiality jokes right now about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we can split the difference and make it furry, but still. Anyway.
Well, exactly that. You can buy Rudolph versions of puppy masks from Mr. S. Leather in San Francisco, and nobody's sexy in a reindeer puppy mask. Personally, your kink is not my kink, but your kink is okay and all that. Like, I'm sure I'm into things that other people who are into puppy play aren't, and vice versa. You know, I don't think puppy masks are particularly sexy. Reindeer? Santa reindeer? Rudolph masks? No.
Somebody did recently pitch me on a porn that they wanted to make. I don't know why they're pitching me, but the Hanukkah-themed porn where over the course of 8 days, gradually the bondage is ramped up and there's wax dripping and all this stuff. That's
the same show where we had Jesus up on the cross. Yeah. We had the human menorah.
Oh.
Which is a little like this human centipede, but not at all like the human centipede. The producer of the Savage Lovecast, Nancy Hartunian, is Jewish, and I brought her out on stage, and we talked briefly about how Jews don't try to sex up Hanukkah. You never see, like, pictures of people with menorahs bent over on their elbows and their holes. Mm-hmm. Like, here's my hole, and here's my menorah. And I was asking her why it is that Jews are so obviously superior in this regard. And then I gave her my Hanukkah present, which was... 8 dancers or 9 dancers, however many candles there are on menorah, in not very much clothing, each holding a candle and gyrating around on the stage.
Okay, that works.
Another thing that you couldn't show on the podcast.
Sure.
That I just did anyway.
There's, speaking of Ben de la Creme, which we were earlier, he's got a character in Homo for the Holidays named Menorah. Menorah and Dreidel. And Dreidel comes out and he's fairly queeny and he's got a fan and he says, introduce himself. He said, I'm Dre, fan, and I'm a top. Perfect.
Some of the best tops in the world are are swishy.
It's true. It's true. There's a conflict. There's a contrast that is.
Oh, I love that contrast.
Sexy. Yes.
I think that's super sexy, that contrast.
Well, yeah, it's you know, all the best characters have layers.
Mm-hmm.
Complex. What was the last show that you actually, like, theater show that you put on?
Miracle, which was a play I wrote from scratch that was a parody of and a riff on The Miracle Worker, William Gibson, which is a perfect example of what I talked about. You make this moment... this iconic moment. In The Miracle Worker, it's the miracle. Water, it has a name. Water, and she gets it, right? When Annie Sullivan breaks through to Helen in her isolation. And Helen then has this trail she can follow into the outside world. She can communicate. And people go see The Miracle Worker in a standard production, and they pat themselves on the back for being there at all, and they sit there waiting for that moment so that they can leave. And maybe they enjoy the show a little bit in the interim. We set Miracle in a drag bar. Helen Stella, like Star, was the adult son but drag queen of Crystal Payne, who is a character based on Crystal Lane, who is a famous drag queen here in Seattle for many years, and had been raised in this drag bar without an education, without... And so we just set The Miracle Worker in a drag bar and made it all strange again. And it was all new dialogue. There was a couple snippets from the actual play because the language is so stilted and melodramatic that it actually worked coming out of the mouths of these drag queens here and there. So there were lines tossed out that were from the real play. Something ought to be done about that child. Things like that. And then when we got to The Miracle, Annie was, it was set in the bar. So instead of water, Helen, it has a name, Helen, water. It was vodka, Helen, it has a name, Helen, vodka. And that scene comes after a fight between Annie and Helen. And so, you know, we had Annie, instead of dragging Helen out with a pitcher to the water pump, dragging her out of the dressing room down to the bar and throwing her onto a bar stool and pulling her head back and pouring vodka down her throat in anger, instead of making her pump water in anger. And we get to this moment, and there is the miracle, and there is the breakthrough. And you look out at the audience for this, like, stupid, crazy, over-the-top drag show, and people are crying because their guards were down. They didn't think that they would even see this moment necessarily, or they weren't anticipating it. They weren't emotionally then braced for it. They didn't have their defenses up. And so when we got to that moment, we were able, by setting Helen Keller's story in a drag bar and rewriting the entire play, make that moment as impactful as it was for the first audience who saw that play.
Well, it seems like the miracle that's going on there, that then it proceeds to, of, like you said, leaving those breadcrumbs for her to venture out into the world. That's essentially what you're doing for the audience with that, is you, like, follow us.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's how it works. And I wish I had, and I love to do that. I love to riff on something that already exists, in the same way that Brown Bag Theater here likes to riff on movies that already exist, movies that people are familiar with. I like to do that with plays.
Yeah, it can't just be camp for camp's sake.
Camp has to have a purpose. You can do a, like, camp rip on anything, and I think camp is a tool where you can create an emotionally effective version of that story. That you don't have to, like, choose between camp and the story you're telling, or camp and the real underlying emotions, or the catharsis in the play. It's not like one or the other. You can do camp and have both. And camp and drag and cross-gender casting, whatever else you want to do, are a really great and a very effective way to take something old and tired and familiar and make it new and different and strange and affecting. And affecting in ways that just not, like, camp is hilarious. That's one way camp is affecting. Emotionally affecting. People were devastated at the end of Miracle. Like, and, you know, it was a dangerous play. People were worried about how the deaf and deafblind community would feel about this play. And the deaf and deafblind community came to it and loved it. I still get attacked for it. I'm still accused of, like, creating this ableist asshole production of the Miracle Worker. But deaf people came to the show and loved it. And, you know, the opening scene when Helen comes out and performs in drag, you know, in the play, Helen Keller walks around the table grabbing whatever food she wants. In my play, Helen Keller walks around the dressing room grabbing whatever makeup she wants to slap on her face, whatever clothes she wants. So she comes out in drag that looks like someone got dragged through a drag landfill. Just, she comes out looking incredibly messy, and she can't lip sync. She can't hear the music. And she could feel it a little bit, but, you know, she walks into walls, she falls down, she verbalizes to the extent that she can verbalize, and, you know, people were shocked and appalled. But then the whole play is about rescuing Helen and pulling her out of this isolation. At the end of the play, you see Helen doing a drag partnered lip sync, hand signing the way you hand sign with the deafblind, where you're making the signs in the hand, and it's a duet with Annie Sullivan. And people were just shattered by that. You know, you got to see Helen become the person that Helen imagined herself to be at the beginning. You got to see her pull out into this drag world. And I'm really proud of that play.
If you could do a show now, what is there a particular show that you're on stage?
Yeah, absolutely. I Can Fix Sweet Charity.
Oh.
Using some of the things I've already done with other plays. I've talked about this forever, and I'm not the first person to think, oh, set Sweet Charity in a gay bar, what? Have them be male taxi dancers. But the problem with Sweet Charity for the musical Theater Queens is you have this, you know, knockout role in Charity, and you don't have a comparable male role. Well, Sweet Charity has three boyfriends, Lothario at the beginning, the movie star at the middle, and then the Nebbish. Make that one actor's part. All three roles. So then it becomes Charity keeps picking the same wrong guy in different disguises. Mm. That she picks the same guy, just different versions of him. And have one male actor play all those roles. That would be amazing. It would be a tour de force in the same way that Charity is, and the play would suddenly be balanced. Also, you get to the end of the play, and there's a shitty ending. So I would do my thing that I do with King John. I would get to the end of the play and say, that's a shitty ending. Here's the last 10 minutes of Sound of Music. And you take it from Edelweiss at the contest, and the male strippers who had played Charity's friends and Charity run in dressed as the Von Trapp children or nuns, and you just do the last 10 minutes of Sound of Music, crazy camp, fleeing over the mountains with Nazis chasing them. That's the end of a play. That's the end of a show.
I love the idea that like the curtain call happens and you're left with this like glowing feeling, even though the story that you're like, wait, but that really was not resolved.
Yeah. I also wanted to do a version of it. There's a theater here that was going to do it. and hired me to direct it, and then they shut the production down after we cast it. Because a production here, this is 20 years ago, a production here of Company got threatened with being shut down because they did some cross-gender casting at a time when Sondheim or his people weren't allowing for that. And they were worried that we were doing this cross-gender casting in charity, and I had also rewritten some scenes and taken some shit out. and we were going to have the audience vote on whether they wanted the last 10 minutes of Guys and Dolls Oklahoma or Sound of Music, and have all three ready to go costume-wise. Like, we were going to have the audience vote, which do you want to see? So that on different nights, it also then is incentive for people to come back. So on different nights, you would see different, that cast, those boys dressed up as, you know, gangsters or cowboys or nuns and Von Trapp children.
I saw a version of Clue in San Francisco that did something similar, where they're like, which of the endings of Clue do you want?
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I hope you get to do that, because that sounds really great.
I would love to do it. And I really think, you know, if you could get Neil Simon and everybody else involved who owns the rights to that, and they're really crazy, to just agree to it. Set it at the Gaiety. For folks who don't know, the Gaiety was the strip club off Times Square for 40 years where boys would strip. Set it at the Gaiety. Bring back the Gaiety. Charity's a stripper. Now, you know, when we originally did this, there was no such thing as gay marriage anywhere in the United States. So, you know, the whole plot point of Charity marrying this guy and escaping her sort of marginal existence as a taxi dancer and, you know, a hooker. They couldn't call her that then. Didn't quite translate, didn't quite play. Well, now there's gay marriage, so now it totally works that some aging boy stripper could meet some man who might marry him, and that's his way out.
There's a wonderful, I don't know, there's sort of a really nice honesty to that of, these are the gay lives that we live these days, and we're going to tell the stories about the gay lives without having to code them, you know, like going way back to Joel Grey's, you know. Wink, wink. We're gay, but not really.
Yeah.
To being able to say, nope, this is it. This is how we live. It's kind of taking the boys in the band of like, here's a peek behind the curtain at the gay life.
Oh, I love that play. I would love to do that play. That's a play I would like to direct.
You're stoned.
Happy birthday, Harold.
You're stoned and you're late. You were supposed to arrive at this location at approximately 8:30-9:00.
What I am, Michael, is a 32-year-old, ugly, pockmarked Jew fairy. And if it takes me a while to pull myself together, and if I smoke a little grass before I get up the nerve to show my face to the world, it's nobody's goddamn business but my own. And how are you this evening?
I would go see that if you directed that.
But I would set it on Mars or something. You'd have to do something crazy with it. You
just it's always got to be weird.
You can't put everybody in, like, polyester and flared pants and do it. You have to do something fucked up with it.
Sure. Either like put them in Shakespeare times and put Shakespeare times into the late 70s and mix them all up.
Yeah. Like audiences, gay audiences come to Boys in the Band already knowing it for the most part. And so you'd have the challenge for you as a director is not just to like try to recreate the frankly awesome film version of it. You have to play with people's expectations and give them something they didn't think they were going
to
get.
Right. And ultimately, it's about getting to some truth that resonates with people.
Yeah. I think if I was going to frame, you know, you watch Boys in the Band and you think, oh, 10 years later, they're all dead. And I think that's what you'd have to do if you did the play now. You'd have to, like, frame it with the AIDS epidemic, frame it with death, that these are ghosts come back to relive this night or something. You have to do something dark and fucked up with it.
Man, ghosts coming back, like Jacob Morley, to talk about, like, in life we forged our bitterness chain by chain.
Yeah, you have to do something, like, fucked up. Even more fucked up than the play itself is. If only we could learn not to hate ourselves quite so much. If only they knew they had so little time to make that happen.
Yeah.
To learn that lesson.
Dan, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you for letting me geek out about theater. I don't get to do that often. We didn't have to talk about sex the whole time. I'm so happy.
Hooray! Just a little bit. Just the right one. Thanks again to Dan for joining me, and of course you should check out his podcast Savage Lovecast, the TV show inspired by his childhood, The Real O'Neills, and his alt-weekly, The Stranger. For my recommendation this week, you have two choices. Either hop on a plane and come visit Seattle to attend the brand new production of Cabaret at the Unicorn Theater, or just watch the movie Cabaret, but with a twist. You see, this new Seattle production of Cabaret has been adjusted for modern times. It's moved out of the pre-war Berlin and into modern-day America. What was previously a reflection of a gay man watching Nazis rise to power is now strangely familiar. We've talked about cabaret on this show before, and it's become vital in a way that I really never anticipated. If you can't make it to Seattle to see this live show, just watch the film, and watch for the parallels. The oblivious young person insisting that politics has nothing to do with her, a woman singing "Maybe Next Time I'll Win" at the Democratic National Convention, a crowd singing "Tomorrow Belongs to Me" while a party official insists that they can be controlled. It's not difficult to find contemporary meaning in the song "Money Makes the World Go Round." For 50 years, cabaret has been a reflection on the past, but now it's a shout of alarm about the future. Or at least, a future. Whatever happens next still hasn't been written. Thanks again for listening. Head over to sewersofparis.com to watch clips of some of the stuff we talked about, or to become a part of the Sewers family by supporting the show for as little as a dollar an episode. Let me know your thoughts on the show at Matt Baume on Twitter, or with a review on iTunes. Big thanks to a mysterious stranger who wrote on iTunes, "The best thing like ever, ever, do yourself a favor and delve deep into this show." Yes, indeed, I welcome delvers of all depths. Come, let us do our delving together. And check out my other podcast, Defining Marriage, for a fun weekly chat about LGBT equality with me and my partner, James. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.